This is Bart Starr of the Green Bay Packers. Go, you Packers! Go!
Oh, man, what better voice than Bart Starr to kick off our conversation with Mark Beach. Mark has put together a book he calls or titled The People's Team, An Illustrated History of the Green Bay Packers. Mark Beach spent more than 18 years at Sports Illustrated before becoming a senior editor at the Players Tribune in 2016. He was introduced to the special relationship between the Packers and their fans after moving to Milwaukee in, I think, the mid-'80s. So you probably know the Packers are the only publicly owned team in any professional sports league, but there's probably a lot you don't know about the green and gold, and so we're going to be talking about that with you today, taking the team through its history and its unique relationship with its fans. Maybe you remember a great moment in Green Bay history, maybe a question about Green Bay history. I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. And Mark Beach, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on, and I'm really enjoying your book. How'd you fall in love with the Green Bay Packers?
I first kind of learned about it. I went to my first game in 1985 at County Stadium in Milwaukee. I'm an Army brat, and we moved around all the time, and so I didn't really have a favorite football team that I liked so much. My dad kind of liked the Redskins, and that's who we'd followed. But when I moved to Milwaukee in the mid-'80s, it became very Packers. It was still a bad era for Packers football then, but it became very quickly an important thing in my life.
Yeah. Was it probably wasn't the Packers that got you interested in sports writing?
No, I mean, I was a big baseball fan, and you know, my mom rides horses, and so I was, knew something about horse racing. And so I've just had a kind of a general interest all along and loved to play, obviously. But, having teams to follow like the Packers and the Brewers and the Badgers and things like that made it very easy to get involved in the sports world in Wisconsin.
Well, I tell you, I haven't gotten through your entire book yet, but I am having a lot of fun reading it. Man, there's a lot here. Talk about how your book's organized, and I love the photography, the photos.
Oh, great. Well, I had an old colleague of mine from Sports Illustrated named Maureen Cavanaugh who helped me acquire and publish those pictures. We had a great time doing it. She was on the phone with some far-flung people. The book kind of runs and sort of, and it's very chronological. It starts in the beginning. Before the beginning, actually. It starts in the beginning for Wisconsin. And how Green Bay was formed when the glacier retreated, more than 10,000 years ago, and sort of takes you through the early history. But it's still connected to the Packers in a way, because the Packers are very connected to the land in that area. You know, the Fox River defines the city of Green Bay much more than the Green Bay itself. And what side of the river you come from determines, in a lot of ways, is part of your Green Bay DNA. But the Packers also, one of their founders is the grandson of the founder of the town, of Daniel Whitney. And so they go all the way back to the beginning of that place almost. You know, Whitney, I think, moved to Green Bay in 1829 from upstate or from New Hampshire. And so it's not a small thing that more than any other team and really any other major North American pro sport, the Packers are so much of the place from which they come.
Yeah.
And I think that, to tell their story, I had to go back to the beginning of Green Bay.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating, fascinating story. And how the first teams, they were, I think it was the division of the Fox River, something like that.
That's exactly right. I mean, it was nominally, I think it was East versus West High School, but the players came from, they were older players in the game too, guys who were not in high school. But it was an East versus West thing, the first game in the city's history. And so it's not a coincidence that East and West. East and West was part of the Packers story right up until they decided where they were going to put Lambeau Field, which at the time was called New City Stadium. So East and West is a big deal, and that's the rivalry between the high schools. Curly Lambeau went to East, gave birth to the rise of the Packers. People saw what a big deal football could be in that town.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And, you know, I think probably everybody listening, or 99.9% of the people listening, know that the Packers are a publicly owned team.
Right.
And I'm not sure everybody understands how that came about. And there's kind of a long history of that whole thing, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, the Packers were a town team. They were sponsored by the Indian packing plant the first season and by the Clare brothers in their second season. Started out as Acme Packing, but then the team sort of divested itself from Acme Packing, which was failing. Acme Packing has grown out of Indian Packing. It's just incredibly complicated little history, but they were a private enterprise for a little while until 1922, when they almost went under. You know, they were on the verge of going under for 50 years, but 22 was sort of the first time. And the publisher of the Green Bay Press Gazette, the business manager, a man named Andrew Turnbull, helped the Packers organize a public stock sale. And that's the first time they became a publicly owned team. So it goes all the way back to the almost beginning.
And the stock sales over time kind of saved the team, if I'm not mistaken.
You know, until the stock sales in the stock sale in 96 or 97, I think it was.
Yeah.
The stock sales were really, they kept the team going. You know, the 23 stock sale saved the team. They sold stock again in, I think, 35, because a disgruntled fan, a fan who'd actually been injured when he fell out of the stands of the game, sued the team into insolvency, just about. And so they held another stock sale that saved the team, and they reorganized. And it's pretty much the present corporate structure of the team was established in the 30s. And then they held another stock sale in the 50s that, again, saved the team. And so, you know, in the 90s was the first time they sold stock to, you know, raise money to do things and not to, you know, stay afloat. And then in 2011, they had another stock sale that was, you know, much that same thing, but only to a greater degree.
And, you know, you think about it, you mentioned 1990, and, I mean, even then, there were some, I mean, Bob Harlan and Ron Wolf kind of saved the team.
They've been saved in more ways than just on a financial ledger. I mean, you know, in the Packers, Bob Harlan took over, I think, as president in 89, and the Packers had a great season that year. You know, Don Majkowski had a magical run, and they won a bunch of games by a point or 7 points or less. But that sort of luck is hard to sustain in the NFL, and they quickly fell back to earth. And Bob Harlan is really, in a lot of ways, the modern-day hero of the story. He really, you know, he's the guy who said, you know, I can't run a football team. You know, I can run the business, but I don't know personnel, and I don't know coaching, and I need somebody to do that for me. And so he hired one guy to be in charge of that operation, and that was Ron Wolf. Ron Wolf came in and said, we've got to get a new coach, and I'm going to trade one of our first-round picks. They had two that year for Brett Favre. And those two things, really turned the team around. And then, you know, a year or two later, he signed Reggie White, and the thing just took off. But that really, that was the moment.
That was the moment. Maddie and DePere has a question for you here. Maddie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I'm a member of the Oneida tribe, and there was a man named by the name of Tom Skenador, who is the reason why Green Bay got to be claimed as title town. And he actually died because of his part of his ear got ripped off into one of the really rough games. and an infection developed. And I want to know if you know anything about Tom Skinnador or any of the Oneidas who were part of that early time. And,
sure. The Oneidas. There were players. I don't think there were any. There were no Oneidas, and I don't think there were no Oneida tribe members on the original Packers teams in 1919 and 1920 when they were, you know, not an NFL operation. But in the early days of town teams, several players from the Oneida Nation played for the Packers, including Tom Skinnador, who I think was paid $20 a game and is the first professional player in the history of Green Bay. Tom is an incredibly important player, and was on the 1897 team that that T.P. Silverwood coached and organized and really turned into a winner. And they became – the 1895 team wasn't very good, but the 1897 team was undefeated. There's a picture of them. It's a terrific picture, but, you know, on the ball that T.P. Silverwood is holding, and he's sitting next to Tom Skinnador, they crowned themselves champions, but nobody's really sure champions of what. but they were undefeated, and you know, that was the first time Green Bay was really, really good at football, and it wasn't too much longer that East and West High School started to play each other.
Matty, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Mark Beach. He is the author of The People's Team, An Illustrated History of the Green Bay Packers. He's got so much to tell us. You know, we're going to spend some time on Curly Lambeau for sure, but a whole lot of other Packers. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news, the weather, and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with our guest, Mark Beach. You stay with us. We'll be back pretty quickly here. Taking a look at a new book out, it's called The People's Team, An Illustrated History of the Green Bay Packers, and it's put together, written by Mark Beach. Mark, a longtime sports writer with Sports Illustrated, senior editor now of the Players Tribune, and he has put together just a fascinating book on the history of our team, I will say. Our team, the Green Bay Packers. I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments as we move along today. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And, Mark, let's talk about Curly Lambeau.
Sure.
For a bit. Tell us what kind of a guy he was and what he did.
Curly Lambeau was a, you know, tremendously energetic guy, a tremendously industrious, you know, self-starting guy who, you know, kept the Packers going through the force of his own willpower, which was considerable for a long time. He was, you know, indefatigable. He was, you know, incredibly, you know, forward-thinking. You know, there's no passing game concepts in the modern NFL or modern football that bear his imprimatur, except the one concept that teams will now throw it almost at any time on any down, and that's exactly what Curly Lambeau did. And he popularized the forward pass in the NFL in a time when, like, you know, you turn the ball over if you threw an incompletion in the end zone. It was not, you know, you had to be behind the line of scrimmage. Your pass had to go like a certain number of yards downfield. It was a different game, and he was willing to use a forward pass quite often, and the Packers became known around the country for that.
And he went out and recruited some really good players back in the in the late 20s. He got Cal Hubbard, for example, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Well, thanks for reminding me. Curly was, you know, he started as a shipping clerk at the Indian Packing Company. But for a long time, he worked at Stiefel's, a men's clothing store in Green Bay, as a salesman. And a salesman is what Curly Lambeau was best at. he sold guys on the idea of coming and playing in the littlest town in the NFL, which was, except for a few brief years in the 20s, Green Bay's always been the smallest town in the NFL. And Curley was especially good at doing that. And one way he was good at it was he'd spent a year at Notre Dame playing for New Rockne in 1918. And he had a Notre Dame network that was all over the country. Frank Thomas, the coach at Alabama, that's how he got Don Hutson. his quarterback, was it Gus Torres? His quarterback at Notre Dame was the coach at Gonzaga out west. Curley had Notre Dame contacts all over the country and found guys, scratch deep enough, and you'll find usually a Notre Dame connection in a lot of those early Packers. But in 1929, he performed probably the greatest sales job in the history of Green Bay. He convinced and got Cal Hubbard, Johnny Blood, who was the first deep threat in the history of pro football, and Mike Mikulski, who's one of the great guards in the history, the early history of pro football, all Hall of Famers to come and play in Green Bay. It was the greatest signing class I can think of. And the Packers, not coincidentally, won the first of their 13 world championships in 1929.
I get that's just an amazing story. I like the fact you had a photo of Hubbard in the book too, along with a note that he became a baseball umpire after
he's the only man who's in both Hall of Fames. He's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame and the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame as an umpire. He retired, I think, for good in about 36 or so. And he'd been working as an umpire for a couple of years and moved up to the majors within a year or two of retiring from football. And was an umpire into the 50s until a hunting accident cost him the sight in one of his eyes. And he became like the supervisor of umpires in the American League. But very good umpire, for a very long time, and a very good football player for a long time. And, Hubbard's another story, Hubbard and Johnny Blood, and it reminds me to mention that in the 20s, Green Bay was one of the most popular stops in the league for players from all over the NFL, because Green Bay was essentially, in the age of Prohibition, a wide-open town. The city fathers kind of looked the other way. The Union Hotel and the pier never finished its basement speakeasy rooms for the simple reason that it didn't have to. It never stopped serving alcohol upstairs. And Green Bay was just, the whole area was very popular. In 1929, the NFL held a meeting in Green Bay. It's still the only league meeting ever held in the city. And Joe Carr, the commissioner, said they had a great time. And of course they did. Because it was a good time to go to Green Bay in those days.
Oh, man. Marcus in Milwaukee has a question for you. Let's go there. Marcus, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. So I was wondering, does the author touch on any of the songs over the years for the Packers that have been produced by fans? Or I believe the Packers had one in the 80s. If I recall, it went something with I'm the tight end, my name is Ed West. I couldn't catch a pass if it hit me in the chest. And I always thought that was terrible, but my brother and I have debated this much. And the other question that my brother and I have debated is Don Beebe the fastest Packer?
Of all time?
Of all time.
Of all time. I am sorry to say I know the answer to neither of those questions. The one part of my history I didn't delve deeply into is the fan music side of it. Outside of the Lumberjack Band, which was started by George Dallaire, who's a Civic Paladin in Green Bay for a long time. The Packers had their fan band was considered, one of the best in football. And they, got their start supporting the team in 1921 in Chicago. They went down. They did play like On Wisconsin and How Dry I Am as they paraded up and down Michigan Avenue. But I don't know. I am sorry to say I did not cover any of the fan-produced songs. As far as Don Beebe being one of the fastest Packers, I'm not totally sure on that. It wouldn't surprise me, but I don't know. When I was a sports writer, when I worked at Sports Illustrated, I did a story on Danny Woodhead at Chadron State. And Danny Woodhead had gotten to know Don Beebe through the years. And I talked to Don Beebe for a story, but I forgot to ask him that question.
Ah, so there you go, Marcus.
All right.
Somebody else may have the answer to that question as they listen in. By the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions. Or, of course, you can also always email us at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Well, Alan in Rib Mountain emailed that as a young boy, he went to a game where the Packers played the Atlanta Falcons and the Packers won. The thing he remembers about the game is the fans went out onto the field and tore down one of the goalposts. I think it was in 68, marched around the field with part of the post on their shoulders. And he wonders, was that a common thing to happen? That was in the 60s.
Yeah, you know, when the Packers won their first world championship, I think in 61, they lost in 60, and they won in 61, and that was the year Green Bay became title town. The Chamber of Commerce and the City Fathers got together, and they dubbed the city title town, and there were banners all over the town for, you know, the weeks leading up to the championship game. It was the biggest game in the history of the city of Green Bay. You know, that the 39 championship game should have been played in Green Bay, but they moved it to Milwaukee for box office reasons. And Green Bay would never forgot about that, not surprisingly. And so the 61 game was a big deal. And after that game, which they clobbered the Giants, they tore down the goalposts. There's actually video on YouTube of them, you know, doing it. They went to work on those goalposts, and they paraded them. I think they dragged them behind a car through the streets of town. They ran that circle on Washington Street and is it Broadway on the other side? And they did that circuit with the bridges over the Fox, and they just went round and round.
Mike in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering if your author had any information about the shenanigans of Paul Hornung and how Vince Lombardi reacted to that.
Yeah, what was the relationship between Hornung and Lombardi?
Well, you know, there's an urban legend that Lombardi called Forrest Gregg the greatest player I ever coached, and that he actually, you know, Cliff Crystal, who worked for the Green Bay Press Gazette and other papers in Wisconsin for years, and is now the team's historian, can find no record of that. Lombardi did talk about Hornung being the best player he had with the Packers, the greatest player he ever coached. Though I don't know that he said those exact words. But, I mean, you look at how important he was to those teams. I mean, the Packers had the best running game in the league in the early 60s, and Hornung was the hammer on the red right 49 on the Packers sweep, because he the whole run to daylight philosophy was made for him. You know, Lombardi had, as the offensive coordinator of the Giants, had turned Frank Gifford into a star as a halfback, and that's exactly what he did with Paul Hornung in Green Bay. He got to Green Bay and told him, words to the effect of, you're my halfback, you're my Frank Gifford. So Lombardi, he was a big game player, and that's what Lombardi thought of him. He had a great nose for the goal line, and Lombardi loved that about him. And he was tough, and the other players loved him. And so, you know, Lombardi could chew Hornung out, and, you know, Hornung could take it, you know, Bart Starr, Lombardi wrote in Run to Daylight, you don't criticize the man publicly. But Hornung, he could criticize publicly and did, because he's Vince Lombardi. Hornung could take it. And the other players loved him. He was a good time guy. You know, I think Dick Schaap came to town, the old sports writer, famous sports writer who wrote, the book with Jerry Kramer.
Yep.
The Instant Replay. And so that, you know, he couldn't believe that what he saw Hornung do and then play on Sunday. You know, he was famous in Green Bay for that. But he was also, you know, before Lombardi showed up, that was all he was going to be famous for. And Lombardi's, you know, devotion to Hornung really changed the lives of both men.
Some great photos in your book, too, of him either running. That sweep, for example, is a great shot of that in your book.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The sweep is it's hard to find pictures of this. That's what Maureen Cavanaugh and I found out, is it's hard to find pictures of that sweep, exactly as it was run. And a lot of times, you know, people will identify the photo of Jim Taylor running to the other side or Horning running to the other side as the sweep, and it's not quite what it was. The sweep was red right 49. It was around the right end. You know, it was very specific what went on, and Lombardi, you know, was very specific in how he ran it, and I can't think of one play in the history of the NFL that defines a team in an era more than that does.
Yeah, for sure. Louie in Wausau, we'll go to you now. Hi, Louie.
Hi, my comment is that I saw a Bear-Packer game in 1939.
Wow.
George Halas was coaching the Bears, and he had just invented the T formation, as it was called, and the great Sid Luckman, who was, I think, the first over-the-center quarterback in the history of football, or he may have been. Anyway, the Packers won 42-28. Go Pack.
Well, the Packers were good in 39. They were world champions. But the T formation, they were slow, or Curly Lambeau was slow in adopting the T formation. I don't think he did until later in the 40s after he won his sixth championship in 44. And the Packers, dragging their feet on adopting the T formation, in some ways put them behind the eight ball. In the late 40s, and it really wound up hurting the team.
Yeah. Louie, thank you so much. Good for you. You saw the 39 game, man. Denny in Crandon, your turn. Hi, Denny.
Thank you, Mark and Larry, for taking my call.
Sure.
My first comment is that my first game was at the 61 championship game with my dad. My questions are, can you discuss what Jack Van Easey did for the Packers in the 50s? And did Green Bay have any town teams the year before 1919? And if so, why did they choose 1919 to be their first year?
All right. Sure. Thank you.
Let me try to remember these. The 61 championship game, that's very cool. That game was awesome. Jack Van Easey in the 50s. The 61 championship was won by a lot of the players that Van Easey had found. He was another guy who'd gone to Notre Dame, and he was a Chicago guy and grew up knowing many of the Bears, but had gone to Notre Dame, and then from Notre Dame he'd played football for a year and I think went into the Army, where he contracted he had terrible heart problems after he got out of the Army, and I think it's because of a disease a fever he came down with in the Far East. He was never Green Bay's general manager. He never made the draft picks himself. Liesel Blackburn drafted a lot of those guys on the 61 championship team, but Jack Van Easey found them, and he had a Notre Dame network, a lot like Curly Lambeau. His buddies from Notre Dame were all over. That's the other gospel of Notre Dame is the gospel of football, and there were guys all over the country spreading it, and Jack knew them, and so he loved Paul Horning. He helped them find Paul Horning. He was in the search for Vince Lombardi. There's a push on to get him into the Hall of Fame right now, and I think that's, I think that's deserved. I think that, somebody should be pushing for him to be in the Hall of Fame because he did some great things. He didn't make the draft picks. I don't think he was ever anything but or more than their chief scout, or at least general manager was never his title. But he found those guys, and he was a draft guru in the days before the draft became big business. Other teams, they wrote about it in the Press Gazette, other teams would consult with Van Easey at the draft because Van Easey knew all those guys and knew where they all went to school and had binders, full of things, on information on players that he kept in his office. He was really, the CPU in the mainframe of the Green Bay personnel department.
Mm.
As far as the early town teams, Curly Lambeau played a few games for the 1918 team, I think, at least one. But he was at Notre Dame. He played a few games in 1917, but not with any consistency. He played more baseball, probably. There were some years in which the town didn't even have teams, and so there was no consistency. There was no sort of constancy of players or teams or coaches or anything like that. But in 1919, the Packers, the Green Bay formed a team that called itself the Packers. from the very first story that was ever written about them in the Press Gazette. You know, the team just had its 100th birthday. They played their 100th season of football last year, but they turned 100 on August 11th. And on August 13th, the Press Gazette ran its very first story about the team, and in that story, it called them the Packers. That's why the team and I both used 1919 as a starting point, because until 1918, it was a rather haphazard sort of mix. You know, there were no scheduled, you know, regularly scheduled games. The 1919 team, they were covered on almost a daily basis in the Press Gazette, not on the front page like the World Series was in the fall, but in the paper, in the sports section.
Interesting. Thank you, Denny, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You know, you have some wonderful stories contributing writers.
Yep.
I know David Neff's piece, Austin Murphy's piece near the end was really interesting.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Yeah.
It is a wonderful piece of writing. You know, the building had... talks about the building having 8 facelifts over the years. And he says in any other city, the field would have been torn down. Why wasn't it torn down?
It was still a good place to watch football. When they renovated the place in 2003 was when they finished.
Yeah.
Lambeau Field was still a, viable place. It was a wonderful place to watch football. It's a terrific football venue.
Oh, it is.
And it really, but it was only open 10 days a year. And they needed to, you know, team generated revenue became a much bigger deal, in the late 90s, and on into today, than it ever had been before. And the Packers are part of a profitable league. They ran a profitable business, but they were falling further and further behind other teams in the league in terms of revenue that they generated on their own and could use on their own, you know, money they could use and spend. And so the renovation was tremendously important. Austin has a great line in his essay, you know, this giant edifice that's plunked down in the middle of a neighborhood with ranch homes in it. I mean, that is in a shot glass, I think is what Austin says. Green Bay's branded. It really is. And so there was never really a move to tear down Lambeau Field, but they had to make it better. They had to make it a place that they could become a year-round destination and generate revenue. And Bob Harlan, of the several heroic things he did for that team, he got that done. He got public money to do it, which that was hard to do after the Brewers had done their stadium deal, which is still not paid off yet.
Yeah,
Lambeau Field is paid off, and it's been so fabulously successful. That in 2011, when the Packers renovated again, they did it all with their own money.
Yeah, and it is a wonderful, wonderful place to visit. Mark, your book, we've touched so little on all of the wonderful things you've got in the book. I know you've got some appearances in Wisconsin. You'll be in Oconomowoc.
Yep,
October 9th at Books and Company. Boswell Books in Milwaukee on October 10th, and then Green Bay, Barnes & Noble on October 11th.
Right.
And the Brown County Library on October 24th. So it's been a real pleasure for me to have a chance to talk with you, Mark. And I love your book, and I haven't finished it yet, but believe me, I'm going to. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, Larry, thank you so much. It's so nice of you to say thank you. It was great to be here.
Mark Beach is the author of the book, The People's Team, An Illustrated History of the Green Bay Packers. I highly recommend it to you. Published by Houghton Mifflin, by the way. Well, thank you so much for listening. Tomorrow, Scott Craven joins us to talk about the latest wildlife updates. And so I hope you'll tune in for that. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.